First, you have to master the body. So kendo is quite unusual, is that you have to master the very basic movements of walking again, or very specific kendo walking, ashisabaki as we call it, and very basic cuts, cutting for the head, cutting for the wrist, the torso, or the throat. It's very specific. It's not like free-for-all where you can just start chopping away any limb. Now that directly translates to the outside, is when you stay focused on one thing, or at most four things. That's the only target you should be going for. Don't let any other distractions get you. If you want to go for that head cut, the men cut, go for it. Don't try to cut his ear off or his nose or his shoulder. Just aim for that one target. And that's a direct translation of, you know, what you're learning to strive for one target in the dojo to take it outside in life. Don't get so distracted with so many other things. Stay focused on what your target is.
Welcome back to the Brain and Brand Show. I'm your host, Timothy Maurice, and today I have a very personal episode I want to share with you. In line with this show's mission of exploring the link between the brain and identity, I've decided to go on a journey to better connect my mind and body. To do so, one of the activities I'm exploring is martial arts. As a kid, like many of us, I was fascinated with the body power and mental discipline of martial artists, from Bruce Lee to the Samurai Warriors. After travels to the East over the past couple of years, that childhood enthusiasm was reignited, and attached to my current goals of mastering my mind and body, I'm on a journey. I'll be bringing you three episodes in this mind-body series. But first up, meet Warren Ho. Warren is a martial arts teacher introduced to me by a friend. After attending a kendo class, kendo, which means the way of the sword, an ancient Japanese martial arts form the samurai used to defend Japan, I was blown away at the power of this art form to mirror my journey and life. Literally, how I moved the sword, how I attacked and defended myself, was literally how I was moving in the world. Warren and I set out to tailor a mind-body program that incorporates many martial arts techniques. So, if you see me on the street, make sure you don't try anything. I don't want to use my dragon slicing technique to humble you. I just made that up. Guys, meet Warren Ho. Enjoy. All right, here we go.
All right.
Welcome back to the Brain and Brand Show. I'm your host, Timothy Maurice, and today we've got a special guest in studio, Mr. Warren Ho. He's a martial arts and self-defense teacher. Warren, welcome.
Thank you, Tim. Great to be here.
You and I met because I was referred to you by a friend of mine who I played basketball with because I was interested in the martial arts. And then I came to a couple of your classes, one being kendo, and then the second being self-defense class. And I was extremely impressed by both the gentle kindness as well as the sheer discipline in your approach. And the ultimate goal of this conversation is to explore the mind-body connection in your sort of philosophies around mind and body and the importance of connecting mind and body. But let's start with who you are and where you grew up. Do you consider yourself South African?
Absolutely. I'm 100% South African. I always call myself the yellow part of the Rainbow Nation. So yes, even though I have Chinese ethnicity, I am 100% South African.
Take us back to where your family comes from. Three generations ago, your grandparents, great-grandparents, which part of Asia were they from?
Yeah, okay. So my dad actually came directly from China. He was from the southern part of China, Guangzhou. And my mother came, she was born in South Africa, so her parents were also from Guangzhou. So that makes me about a 2.5 generation, you know. But yeah, I've been back to China quite a few times, and every time I go, there's such amazing development in China. It's still considered the motherland. My dad loves there, and obviously, we still pay a lot of respect to where we come from.
Sure. Every region of the world has a sort of an identity. If you go to India, you think of, you know, eat, pray, love. You go to west part of America, you think of the IT sort of Instagram, Facebook hub of the world. What's interesting about your connection between China and South Africa is that your identity, both regions sort of come through when engaging you. And tell us a little bit about the South African in you versus the Chinese person in you in terms of who you have become.
Wow, that's a very deep question. And I think growing up in apartheid South Africa, it was a very confusing time for me. And I had to ask myself exactly those questions. So just to put it in context, I was 18 when apartheid was abolished in South Africa. So that makes me quite an oldie. But up until 18, I was at a Chinese school. for a number of years before I transitioned to a non-Chinese school. So I was questioning a lot of, you know, am I Chinese or am I South African? When I am here in South Africa back then, I didn't feel South African enough. I was segregated and put into a Chinese sort of area only. When I went back to China, it would be, well, you know, you're not Chinese enough. You don't even speak our language perfectly. So I was very confused as to where I was. And it was only after reading Nelson Mandela's book, actually, A Long Walk to Freedom, that I really got an understanding as to the, you know, what was happening in South Africa. And this was quite a few years later during my varsity years that I read the book. And I really go, wow, did that really happen in the 18 years that I grew up in South Africa? You know, my parents had shielded me so well from sort of the apartheid sort of regime that it was almost oblivious to me. There were obviously telltale signs, you know, things like being confined to certain areas that we could stay in, that we could work in. But that for me was, I thought it was just normal until I sort of realized that it wasn't that normal. So that is sort of my South Africanness. I had to come to terms with being South African Chinese.
Sure.
And that was, you know, sort of my definition of who I am. I have Chinese ethnicity. We pay homage to our culture, our heritage. But at the same time, I'm very South African. You know, I love the typical braais. I love eating biltong and droewors. and, you know, I speak an African language, well, both a little bit of Zulu and Afrikaans. But yeah, that makes me, I think, very South African in all the senses.
Which can you speak better, Mandarin or Afrikaans or Zulu?
Oh, that's okay. So my parents would probably put their head in shame, but I speak Afrikaans better than I do Chinese, Mandarin, or Cantonese.
Are you serious?
I am serious.
But you can engage. If you meet someone who is, you know, who can't speak English and they speak Mandarin or Cantonese, you can engage them.
Yes, absolutely. So probably just very rudimentary engagement. You know, hi, how are you? What do you need? But when they start waffling off in terms of what they really need, then I'm like, okay, I need Google Translate. I need a proper translator or phone dad. Dad, help me out. Yeah.
I have enough Asian friends to know that the stereotype of everyone in China knowing martial arts is not the case. So how did you come across the martial arts and create the sort of career where you teach and instruct and inspire people to go on a lifelong journey of connecting their mind and body?
Okay, so interesting journey. I mean, like all kids and probably a lot of Asian kids, we watched a lot of Chinese series that were based on sort of ancient times of Chinese folklore and superheroes or martial artists that could fly through trees, you know, shoot beams of magic through their hands. So there was a lot of Chinese series that I watched when I was a kid. And obviously the Jackie Chan movies were big and a lot of Hong Kong cinema. And that sort of influenced my decision to do martial arts. I didn't really get an opportunity very early on, purely because even though I did some karate at school, my dad's working program was too hectic to take me on the weekends. So it was only during varsity that I really got into Taekwondo, which is a Korean martial art. Wasn't exactly what I wanted to do, but the teacher that was instructing it was amazing. So I decided to learn Taekwondo from him.
And what in that moment when you first connected with Taekwondo,
yes,
what was it about that you enjoyed?
So Taekwondo, and specifically WTF Taekwondo, or is it called WT Taekwondo now, is the Olympic style. It's characterized by dynamic kicks, high-flying kicks, flying kicks, reverse hook kicks, and, you know, just the sheer sort of visual entertainment of it was amazing, and that's sort of what attracted me. What was more amazing is actually having someone, my instructor, Scott Crowder, do it in front of you, and it was like, man, this guy is defying the laws of gravity. He's like floating on air. How does he do that? And I wanted to learn that. It was everything I'd seen when I was a kid. Guys flying in the trees and kicking in the air. He was doing exactly that.
And what level did you get to in this particular discipline?
So in Taekwondo, I'm a fourth degree black belt. And then I decided to sort of pursue my kendo career because it was very difficult doing both. They have very conflicting principles. So I stopped when I was a fourth degree in Taekwondo.
So my first class that I came to was kendo. Tell us a little bit about the history of kendo and you know, your work around kendo.
So kendo is a Japanese martial art, and it's sort of derived from the art of the samurai. So our very uniform is sort of modeled after the samurai's armor, from the headgear to the torso protector to the gauntlets, or the ones that protect your wrists. All of it is supposed to represent a samurai. And the sword, absolutely. You know, everybody knows or sort of links the samurai to a katana or a sword, and that's where kendo comes from. What got me started was my taekwondo instructor wanted to do a traditional martial art like kendo, and he was the one that introduced me to it. My first thought was, this is crap. There's no practical application. You know, we're hitting each other with swords, there's armor. It's not real like the taekwondo that I knew, where you could knock people out, as in KO them. So I had a bit of resistance initially, but afterwards, and it was after I broke my hand doing kendo, I took a year break, came back, and it was thereafter I sort of fell in love with it.
Oh, wow. And you look at this particular, at some point in kendo, in the history in Japan, the samurai was really seen as a high discipline, high level figure in society.
Yes. So the samurai were, from a hierarchy perspective, were basically right after the emperor and the shoguns. They were the sort of the, what would you call them, the army that would control the population. So the samurai were very highly regarded, and because they followed a very strict code of Bushido, you know, they were totally loyal to their master, and if they didn't have a master, they were required to take their own lives. So they had a very strict code of conduct and discipline that required them to train constantly and just be in their constant mindset that, you know, today might be the last day. Hence the whole Sakura analogies that, you know, the samurai's dream was to die on the battlefield, to die when he was at full bloom. So there was that always that ethos of Bushido, which samurai, you know, back then used to follow.
There are many reasons why someone would pursue a journey in and around the martial arts. You know, one of the funny reasons is your Instagram will be popping because this stuff looks really, really cool.
Yeah.
But I can imagine the reason why you decide to teach this is to help people connect their mind and body, their spirit, and have more sort of been able to channel themselves at a high level. When did you actually start decide, I'm going to teach this?
So very interesting. You know, when I decided that, it was a conscious choice, but it was also a journey that I had to go through. I've always loved martial arts, and I've experimented probably on two dozen different martial arts. You know, Taekwondo is one of them. So was Kendo, Wing Chun, Hapkido, Sistema, Krav Maga. And what I found with Kendo is that Kendo has so much depth to it. The whole ethos of Kendo is about self-development through the use of a sword. And that's how they punt it. Now, the idea is the deeper you go into Kendo, the deeper you understand yourself. At the end of the day, is when you're standing in front of an opponent, that opponent is really just a reflection of yourself. And what you face there is your fears, your doubts. Whatever you might have, that becomes your opponent. And kendo teaches you that. And when I realized that, I'm like, wow, this can be more than just martial arts. This goes beyond just body. This goes to helping someone understand what happens in their mind, and even at a deep level, what happens from them spiritually. So that's why I decided to start teaching it.
One of the things that blew me away in that first class that I attended was you said that you can tell by how a person moves and engages you often what's happening in their life.
Yeah.
Explain that.
So I have a basically an analogy. What happens in the dojo is just a microcosm of what happens to you outside the dojo. The dojo is the training hall that you engage in.
Okay, the training hall. Okay.
Yeah.
What happens in the training hall?
Yeah, what happens in the training hall or the dojo is just a microcosm of what's happening in your life. So I can only be your sensei in the dojo, and this is what I tell my students. But looking at what you do and how you interact with me during keiko or during a sparring session can tell me a lot as to what's happening outside your life. Whether you have a lot of frustrations, you're fighting with anger, you know, there's something at work that's sort of hampering you from performing. I can see that when you start cake with me, it's all rigid and hard, or you're frustrated, or you're fighting angry. And then I can immediately tell, listen, something's not going right in your life, you're taking it out here. And that's the right place to take it out. Take it out in the dojo rather than taking it out there. And the idea is it's a flip side. If you can manage it in the dojo, you can manage it outside there as well. And that's what I try to teach my students. That's one of many, you know. I've had many of my students say to me they feel so much better after kendo, and that translates to having a better relationship outside the dojo, whether they go home and they're more relaxed, they're more calm, or something as simple as just driving on the roads, you know. When they get back, yeah, like, well, is it really worth it? Can I just drive on the road without being a victim of road rage? And that's where kendo comes in a lot of time, being able to control that anger, those negative emotions and depression.
Let's talk about that. Let's talk about specifically how the art, being inside of the dojo and being in the space, learning the art, performing, engaging it naturally, how that translates into the real world and how that translates. Mm-hmm. Let's talk specifically about how that actually works. Is it the repetition? Is it the understanding? What part of the process is actually helping you apply yourself into the real world?
Okay, so it's a three-part, let's call it a three-phase thing, right? First, you have to master the body. So kendo is quite unusual, is that you have to master the very basic movements of walking again, or very specific kendo walking, ashisabaki as we call it, and very basic cuts, cutting for the head, cutting for the wrist, the torso, or the throat. It's very specific. It's not like free-for-all where you can just start chopping away any limbs.
And by the way, you're using, the sword is actually a wooden sword.
It's bamboo sword, yes.
Bamboo sword. It's not actual, you're not cutting people.
Correct. Okay. And you are quite protected with the armor. But the idea is that it's only those four targets which you need to discipline yourself to be able to hit and strike those only. Now, that directly translates to the outside is when you stay focused on one thing, or at most four things. That's the only target you should be going for. Don't let any other distractions get you. If you want to go for that head cut, the men cut, go for it. Don't try to cut his ear off or his nose or his shoulder. Just aim for that one target. And that's a direct translation of, you know, what you're learning to strike for one target in the dojo to take it outside in life. Don't get so distracted with so many other things. Stay focused on what your target is.
Whether you're creating content, whether you are running for president or whatever you're doing, zoom in on that target.
Absolutely.
And it was interesting. I mean, you know, just coming from one session, I remember leaving thinking that typically in a fight, if you're not trained, you don't have this sort of self-mastery, you are kind of all over the place. You're just swinging. If you think about a kid who gets into a fight, they just hands are just, if you think about it, their hands are just going all over the place. They're not, there is zero focus, right?
For sure.
And it seems like that's what's happening with people in this uncertain economy.
Yeah.
We just kind of swing in and all over the place.
That is so true, you know. And, you know, one of my taekwondo instructor made a very good point the one time. He said, you could be swimming in an ocean, but if you're heading off nowhere, you're eventually going to drown and lose steam. So you've got to be aiming for a shoreline to get to safety. So martial arts training is exactly that. You've got to have a focus as to where you're going. And as you said, you know, out in life, if you're just swinging and swaying in real life, you're going to be doing nothing and causing, maybe you'll get an accidental hit, but eventually you're going to lose energy and you're going to gas out and you're going to go down.
All right, so you took us through the first phase is just kind of mastering body. The second phase was?
The second phase is mastering your mind.
Mastering the mind.
Yeah, and there specifically, you know, kendo teaches us something called the shikai, or the four poisons of the mind. And those basically are fear, doubt, hesitation, and surprise. Those are the four things that we as humans, we're all subjected to. Now, kendo gives you the ability to face those fears directly. There's no other way to explain it than the raw emotions when someone's in front of you trying to beat the crap out of you. You'll feel fear. You'll doubt your own skill. You'll hesitate because you're scared, and you'll be caught by surprise. Now think about that, how you can take those mental faculties that you learn in kendo, how you would translate that to maybe in a boardroom, right? Your CEO walks in. All of a sudden, you know that he wants to fire a couple of people. Are you fearful? Are you going to doubt your abilities? Are you going to be surprised, or are you going to hesitate? So those things can directly translate to something that you could use outside your life. And I'm using the boardroom as an extreme. Okay, you don't want to be beating up your CEO by all means.
Sure.
Yeah.
And then the last phase.
The last phase is obviously the emotional, the spiritual phase, is where you delve deeper into kendo and really start looking what's inside of you and questioning, you know, is this the best that you can do? And kendo gives you that ability to constantly push. And you'll dig deep. The idea is that you'll dig very deep. I push my students to the point of exhaustion. You know, one guy nearly passed out the one time. And he beat himself up so much. He was saying there was only 2 minutes left, but he couldn't do it. But it was good enough for him. And that's where he had to dig deep to see how much does he have. And it's not about physical or mental capacity. It's about digging deep somewhere where sometimes you might have to go even deeper than just what's on the surface. And that's where the spiritual side comes in.
The second class I came to was a self-defense class, and one of the things that blew me away is that you spoke about, you know, how much of this journey of engaging crime really starts in our own mind.
Yeah.
And how often we attract certain things and so forth. And sometimes you can't escape, you know, when you live in a society where there's so much brutality and violence, you can't escape. But when you were speaking, helping people understand that how you engage that moment and that level of mastery. Take us through some of the thinking around the self-defense philosophy.
Right. So most people, when they teach self-defense, they always mention awareness. The first and foremost thing which they mention is awareness. I take it back and say, well, the first thing really is self-awareness. You got to understand yourself first. Understand what makes you tick, what triggers you. And the question, or the primary question that I call it, is what are you willing to fight, die, and kill for? And that you really have to dig deep. Is that before you can even learn any self-defense, you got to understand what are you willing to fight, die, and kill for? We can break that into three things. What are you willing to fight for? Now, are there things, people, or ideals that you would fight for? Now, take the next level is, what are you willing to die for? Are there people, things, and ideals that you would die for? Let's think of Nelson Mandela. He was willing to risk his life for the freedom of this country. It was an ideal that he believed in. He would die for that. You got to ask yourself, are you willing to die for something like that as well? If it's not, then is it worth fighting for? Then the last one is, are you willing to kill for it? And the idea is, should you ever be faced with a choice that you had to take another life to preserve your own life or the life of a family, could you, would you be able to do it? And that's something which borders on ethical or religious. It depends on what you are. And most people don't think about that. They respond emotionally rather than rationally. And that's what makes them a target for people that are looking for soft targets. You got to understand yourself.
I want to shift to, if anyone's listening and they're thinking, I want to contact you and I want to engage you and I want to go on this journey of connecting my mind and body, we're going to give out your details in a moment. Awesome. But for those people who may be listening in another region of the world, what are three things they can start doing as soon as they finish listening to this podcast to start making this mind-body connection?
Yeah. So as I said, it starts with the body first. You got to find something which you can discipline yourself to do every single day. You know, whether it's just getting up and doing 10 push-ups, 10 sit-ups, get that discipline, that routine. Discipline is synonymous with routine. Routine is synonymous with boring. So a lot of people get bored and they don't have the discipline. But if you are focused on what your target is, remember, just going for that one target, I want to lose weight, or I want to have a more positive mindset, or I want to eat healthier, do something every day that will give you that discipline. That would be my number one thing.
Number two.
Confidence. Have confidence, get started. Most people don't want to get started because one of the things is they're fearful. They doubt their skills, their abilities, they hesitate, or they're surprised. So you need to overcome those things to be able to get started. So confidence is another big topic which I love talking about, but it is one of the things where you have to dig deep and find what gives you the confidence. What are those positive motivators for you that will give you the confidence to get started? And that would be something practical. Find something that makes you feel good, all right? And do more of that. Now, obviously, make sure it's good and not a vice like drinking or,
sure.
Yeah.
We know the neurobiological chemicals start to shift when you change your body.
Yeah.
And, for example, the Superman pose and so forth. Any tips in terms of helping you boost your confidence by certain movements with your body?
Yeah. So breathing. So for me, a big part of it is breathing and sort of mindful meditation. Now, mindful meditation for me is when you meditate, don't fall asleep, all right? Try to be focused as to where you are and breathe in. And that for me is a great way to sort of, build up that mindfulness and boost your confidence. If you can get that started at the beginning of every day, you'd have a great day.
Number three
is about resilience. Getting up when you get knocked down. And that's a big one for a lot of people. Is that, yeah, you're going to get knocked down, but the idea is you have to get back up. And we have a saying in Karate Proverbs, you get knocked down 8 times, you got to get up 9 times. So that's the idea. If you get knocked down, get back up. And it's not as easy as, it's easy to say, it's harder to do. But the idea is you need to find something that will pull you back up. Whether it's someone, something, or some goal that you're trying to accomplish, don't give up on that. I know it sounds very frivolous, but that's the best I can describe the resilience part of it.
What I appreciate about the way you teach and you're in the space that you create is a safe space.
Right.
Number one is no judgment. The class I came to, there were people there that were about to graduate something. They were like near masters, and then there were beginners.
Yeah.
And I felt the community.
Great.
That was the first thing. The second thing that I appreciated was the sense that, this is rare to find. is that there was so much diversity.
Mm-hmm.
There were women. Women are different races. There were people from all sorts of backgrounds. And how do you get that right? Because in a country where people kind of live in silos,
right?
How do you get that right?
Well, I think sports and martial arts, just by their very definition, allows everybody to sort of compete. Kendo specifically allows everyone of all races, all ages, and any gender to compete on the same playing fields. It's not about strength. It's not about speed. It's about doing proper technique. You're armored up and you have both swords, but the idea is the person with the greater technique will win. And in my dojo specifically, we have a lot of fun, but our primary principle is to be very focused on our training. We have focused training, lots of fun, but we're also family, and that's what I like to endorse and keep pushing at our dojo.
You regard yourself as a lifelong learner. Why?
Lifelong learner, absolutely. You know, I think every opportunity that I get, I'd like to learn something new and challenge myself to see, listen, can I push myself a little bit higher? It's all about elevating ourselves to a higher standard, hold ourselves higher to a standard. I think for that, for me, is my challenge as a martial artist and as a person.
Do you have any personal goals, any other levels? Is there something above third degree something? Is there any other are there any other levels you want to get to as a sensei?
I think as a sensei, I would just like to teach more. I think that's one of the things I found myself enjoying teaching and seeing people grow, not only as kendoka, as we call them, but as people. My youngest student is 13 at the moment, and I've been training her since she was 11, 10, and she's becoming a beautiful young woman, confident, strong in herself, and you know, I want to see more moments of that as a sensei. So it's not for me, but it really is about being able to share what I've accumulated.
And your oldest student?
My oldest student is 54, sorry.
54.
Yeah, he was in Germany at the time you were there, but he's back.
Awesome.
Yeah.
Warren, thank you for joining us on the Brain and Brand Show.
Thank you, Tim. It was great. Thank you.
A pleasure. Thanks so much, Warren, for your dedication to teaching people how to connect their mind and body. You can check out Warren's work at his website, www.warrenho.net, and that's warrenho.net, or you can email him warren@warrenho.net. As you go away and allow this content to marinate, remember this quote by Aya Kemba: if the whole universe can be found in our own body and mind, this is where we need to make our inquiries. We all have the answers within ourselves. We just have not got in touch with them yet. The potential of finding the truth within requires faith in ourselves. Make sure you share this episode with a friend or colleague and do rate us. Until the next one.